Accession number 30018, reel 2.
Do I follow reel 2?
Okay, so I bumped into Ralph Maltby. He was coming down the staircase, and I obviously recognised him, and he clearly recognised me, and he said, "I know you," and he stopped and stared and said, "Take that bloody hat off," and I took my hat off. He said, "Christ, Farley," and I said, "Hello, Ralph," and so small world, isn't it? But really it wasn't that surprising, because it was only 8 years since I had finished my apprenticeship, and indeed I could recognise a lot of the research programmes that were going on at Bedford and at Farnborough when I joined as a test pilot from those days, junior test pilot, from those days of my apprenticeship.
And with your apprenticeship, how many departments would you visit during that period? I mean, you mentioned the craft things, but I was thinking of the other departments.
Well, it was 3 a year, so I suppose it was 9 scientific departments that we went through. And 5 craft ones, because the first term was spent wholly in the workshop of the college. They had a sort of introductory workshop where you could learn the fundamentals before you were sent to one of the proper working workshops in the factory. Otherwise, you wouldn't have been much use. We did a lot of.
So that was to give you the basic kind of skills, was it? I take it with me. What type of other apprentices were there? I mean, I'm thinking of, you know, their kind of background. You've explained yours, but was everybody the same, or had some technical training?
No. Nobody had any technical training. Majority of them were probably of the student apprentices had probably had a better academic education than myself, more maths and so on. But no, there were all standards of people. And in terms of the number of craft apprentices, I mean, I think we were probably talking of 80 or 90 a year were taken on, and it was about 30 student apprentices a year. I mean, it was an amazing training system. But the whole thing recognised that you needed to continually put new people into the bottom of that sort of research establishment, whether they be craftsmen to build the wind tunnel models, or, you know, modify the aeroplanes or whatever, or whether it was the scientists. And there was this forward-looking approach. Well, forward-looking, there was this altruistic, I suppose, approach to the need for training. It wasn't, we can't afford to train anybody because, you know, we're not making enough profit. There was none of that going on in those days. It's a pity, really, because the world has changed. I mean, the Royal Aircraft Establishment became the Defence Evaluation and Research Establishment Agency, Defence Evaluation and Research Agency. And then it became Kinetic, and is Kinetic today. But if you go into Kinetic departments today, which had their origins at Farnborough, and in fact Kinetic still have a big site, new site built on the southwest corner of Farnborough, if you go in there now, it looks the same as the aircraft industry to me, in that everybody is working on a particular project against a particular budget, and that's that sort of thing. And you don't walk into offices and find people sitting there thinking. Shame, really.
So would you say there was a whole ethos and atmosphere to the place that didn't continue and has never really been replicated anywhere else in the aircraft industry?
Certainly it didn't continue, but I wouldn't want to suggest it stopped dead. I mean, the world has changed in the last 50 years. The whole world has, and this sort of research attitude has changed. I'm quite sure that there are people working in, shall we say, astronomy, who have still got the same approach to thinking, but it's not there in engineering or broad-based science anymore, because we've got such a database of information. We can do most things if you'll pay us to do them, right?
we kind of left off a little bit because you'd had your interview with the Commandant and you're going about, how did you go about applying for the RAF?
Yes, the you could in those days apply for something called pre-assessment. And you went along and you did the medical and you did the aptitude tests, and you were then told, yes, when you finish your training scheme or when you choose to, you know, if you come along and apply to be, in my case, a pilot for the Royal Air Force, we will accept you. In other words, you didn't have to, you didn't wait and do it sequentially such that you finished your training, then applied again to the Air Force, then found you couldn't, now what we're going to do, and you've wasted a lot of time. So you could go along for pre-selection. And did I say pre-assessment? Pre-selection, I think it was called. And so I did that. I had a bit more confidence, of course, as a, was 22 then, coming up, 21, a bit more confidence than I did when I was the 16-year-old lad approaching the RAF trailer on the pier, but I still had to worry about the medical side. And I can remember standing there in a long line of about 10 chaps, all of us with no clothes on at all, and this wing commander with a clipboard, you know, walking slowly along the line, looking us up and down and making the odd note. And he stopped in front of me and he looked down at my feet and then he looked slowly all the way up in the way a doctor does, you know. And he said almost to himself, not to me, "That's a nice job with your toes. I wonder who did that." And walked on to the next guy, you see. And nothing more was ever said about my toes. Nobody said anything about my finger, which I'd bust, you see. Except by an RAF flight sergeant at Officer Cadet Training Camp, who thought when I saluted I was taking the mickey, you see, and so it gave me a hard time, but it wasn't the case. It was just the way my finger stuck out. Anyhow, there we were. I got into the Air Force and did my flying training.
What aircraft did you learn to?
Again, I was very lucky. I guess old men looking back on their youth often do think they were lucky, but I think I can justify saying it. I was taught to fly on piston provosts, 550 horsepower, tail-dragging single-piston aeroplane, side-by-side. I had a master pilot instructor. Master pilot was the highest grade of non-commissioned air crew. It was equivalent of a warrant officer. He'd flown his way through the Second World War. Brilliant pilot. I felt I got on so well with him, again, in a master-servant relationship. He insisted I call him sir, and he got no argument from me, although he was required to call me sir because I was a pilot officer at that stage, because that's how you join Air Force. But that never crossed my mind, and it, as far as I was concerned, one's instructor was sir, you know, and that was that. So I was very lucky with my instructor.
What was the sequence of instruction at that time? Did it differ very much from
today?
Today, or thinking previously with the training that was brought on in the Second World War, was there much of a difference in the 50s?
I suspect not in the 50s, in that it was probably similar to the Second World War, because, you know, that was only 5, 6, 8 years earlier sort of thing, and the people who were doing the instructing when I joined the Air Force were the people who had survived the Second World War. And I have no reason to think other than they regurgitated the sort of training that they themselves received.
What pattern did that take?
Sorry?
What pattern did the training take?
Well, looking back on it, it seems pretty thin. One wasn't conscious of instructional technique and so on. One wasn't conscious of the instructors being well trained to be instructors. I don't think that had happened. I mean, that happened later. These were just people who gave you a hard time, and if you'd got the ability to get on with it and improve, then you became a satisfactory student. It was hard school in those days. I think, not that I'm complaining, nothing wrong with hard school I remember Jimmy Heinsohn saying to me more than once, of course, you've got a tremendous advantage over the other students on your course because you understand aeroplanes, you see. I understood them to a much greater depth than was being taught to the other pilots. I mean, this is an aileron chaps, it goes up and down, you know, and it makes the aeroplane roll, sort of thing. And well, I understood the ailerons, I knew the different types and what they were for and how you design them, type of thing, because I've been taught. So, yes, I was lucky. We went from Piston Provost, on which we did about 90 hours, to Vampires. And Piston Provost were at Hull Avington on a grass airfield. Vampires were at Swinderby on a classic three hard runway type Second World War airfield.
What was your impression of the Piston Provost as an aircraft?
Well, I thought it was a big beast, of course, in those days. And it was. I mean, 550 horsepower was quite a lot compared to, shall we say, the Tiger Moth or something, which people had learned on not that many years earlier. I enjoyed it. I don't think I ever really felt I knew how to land it. By that I mean I never knew how a landing was going to turn out until it had happened. And that may seem a funny thing to say, but I couldn't have said to you, this is going to be a good landing, that's going to be a bad one, when I'm still 50 feet up. And funnily enough, when I was at the Empire Test Pilot School, the aeroplane I was given for the takeoff and landing exercise, because you were taught various test flying exercises, takeoff and landing was one, where you are given an aeroplane to assess for takeoff and landing characteristics. You have to decide what tests you're going to carry out. There are, in the case of takeoff and landing, a whole bunch of cases that have to be demonstrated by the test pilot. You know, landing tail wheel first, landing left wheel first, landing right wheel first, landing heavy, doing it nicely, landing on two wheels, whatever, crosswind. And you tick off. And I remember writing all these down on my test card before setting off on the first trip, thinking, I'm going to be in trouble here with this Piston Provost. But then something had happened to me, and between the time that I had first flown it and when I was on the course at ETPS, which was 1956 through to 63, so it was 7 years, I had obviously learnt to fly, because I could present the Piston Provost to the ground in the way that my test card required it to. Left wheel first, right wheel first, good landing, bad landing, you know, whatever. Some of those sort of situational awareness skills that you pick up take some years perhaps to settle in. But I did not know how to do it when I left. I mean, I was obviously safe, or I wouldn't have been passed out, but you know, the actual sort of quality of things was a bit 90 hours flying, for goodness sake.
How did you feel, obviously, soloing for the first time?
Yeah, I mean, you wanted to do it. I think Jimmy Heinsohn probably had me down as having average aptitude and average attitude to the thing. That I suspect he did. Certainly when I became an instructor later on, you would try and decide before you sent somebody solo this business of, are they underconfident, overconfident, or just right? You can handle underconfident to an extent, and in fact better that the chap is a little underconfident than a little overconfident, certainly. But you don't want them to be too underconfident when you send them off. In fact, you wouldn't send one off if he was extremely underconfident, because he might come apart when he finds himself on his own. So I presume that Jimmy Heinsohn, in deciding to let me go, on the day he decided to let me go, had me down for being confident enough or about right in that regard. He wouldn't have let me go if I was overconfident, I'm sure. And I think I would have recognised, looking back, if he had ever thought I was overconfident, because he would have jumped all over me like a cheap suit, you know. I mean, I think my confidence, which is what you asked me about, how did I feel, did I feel confident? I felt possibly, certainly apprehensive. I wasn't scared. I think you need to be apprehensive at times when you're doing something to give of your best, don't you? Otherwise you're just too laid back, you know. So, yeah, I mean, I did it. But it was totally in my head. It was a, good Lord, there's nobody there sort of thing on the downwind leg. It was churning out the numbers and techniques that I had been taught to do in the circuit. And so I did them, landed and taxied in. I was pleased to do it. But I don't think this anything quite, well, there was nothing very special for me about that first solo. If by special you mean what was going on in my head, it was just, my head was full of what I had been told to do, making myself do it, not making a mistake with the checks. You know, you're in this executing as professionally as you can something you've been well trained to do. This is not a big emotional moment. This is a practical business of dealing with an airplane. You've been taught to do this, that you must do.
Because I was wondering, because you'd reached a stage, obviously, that you'd been wanting to do since you were a child, of being in control of an aircraft, that would allow you to carry on and do what you want to.
Sure.
I just wondered if there was anything in your head that marked that kind of
moment. No, I mean, I was relieved when I'd done it, because it was another stage in the training. But my nature is not to, and still is for that matter, when you achieve a stepping stone, is not to be terribly pleased about the stepping stone, but to start worrying about the next one. And so now was, okay, well, am I going to be able to do instrument flying? Am I going to be able to do aerobatics? Am I going to, you know, do navigation? Am I going to be able to... And so I was always concerned about passing the course. So in that respect, I suspect I was probably slightly underconfident. And you only really enjoy things when they're done. I mean, later on in my career as a test pilot, I used to go give flying displays at Farnborough and so on, and in the normal course of doing one's job. I never enjoyed doing them until they were done. Then you could sit back and say, great, did that, got it right. Up until you had done it, whatever it was, you're mainly professionally concerned with not boobing, you know, and getting it wrong.
Is there always a certain element of apprehension?
Certainly.
And is that a good thing?
Absolutely. I don't think you can fly airplanes safely without a degree. Apprehension perhaps is slightly too strong a word for the regular, ordinary flight in another aeroplane that you have flown many times before. You won't be apprehensive there. You will just be concentrating and focused, to use these modern words. You might be apprehensive when you come to do a new one, but apprehensive, or my definition of apprehensive, will be super alert, super concerned to get it right.
Is it then a healthy respect for the process?
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. Any time anybody gets airborne in an airplane, they can break the airplane or they can kill themselves. I mean, it's just a simple fact of life. I don't care who you are and I don't care what the airplane is. It doesn't matter if the airplane's got a maximum speed of 90 miles an hour, you know. It has still got that ability to be broken or to kill you if you're flying it. And you must give any aeroplane that level of respect. It isn't just aeroplanes that are flown at Mach 2, 50 feet upside down in the middle of the night or something. They're not the only aeroplanes that you have to give respect to. You have to give respect to the whole lot. And more recent years, the last 10 years or so, I've had, perhaps even 15, I've had more of an association with the general aviation scene and private pilots and people flying as a hobby and so on. And I spend a lot of my time trying to convince those sort of people that the aeroplanes they are flying themselves, either they own it or they rent it from a flying club, are much, much harder to fly than the aeroplanes that the Royal Air Force operational pilots are flying at the moment. They find this impossible to believe. They think that a Tornado or Eurofighter or something like that must be very difficult to fly, and this little Cessna or Oster is got to be easy, because they relate difficult to high speed and easy to low speed. It isn't that at all. If you define fly as go left, go right, go up, go down, go faster, go slower, in other words, just steering it through the sky, you could teach Granny to land a tornado in 1 hour. If she was not mentally upset by being in that environment, if she could think, you could teach her to land it, because it does not require, and nor should a modern aeroplane require, those sort of handling skills. We know how to design aeroplanes, we know how to design flight control systems. They fly on rails, they are the easiest possible things to steer. And so they should be, because the job that the pilot has got to do in the aeroplane is incredibly difficult. The job, the operational job. The operational job that a Eurofighter or Typhoon Tornado or Harrier pilot's got to do is extremely complicated, very demanding, and probably, if not the hardest job in the world, amongst the hardest jobs in the world for anybody to do. But that's not to suggest that the aeroplane is difficult to steer through the sky. The aeroplanes that the private pilot uses are difficult to steer through the sky. They were designed 40, 50 years ago. They don't have the sort of equipment and flying control systems and autopilots and goodness knows what that modern military and civil airliners have. This is why we can quite safely put a pilot in the right-hand seat of a civil airliner, where he is the first officer, and if the captain dies, he's got to land the airplane, and he's got a couple of hundred hours total flying, you know. That's not a criticism, that's a statement of fact, that if he has to take over, the procedures and processes of actually getting the thing on the ground are not demanding of those sort of skills which in the Second World War days took months or years to acquire, and many people never did acquire before they were killed, either by accident or by enemy action, more likely by accident. Sorry, does that make sense at all?
We kind of left the narrative a little bit.
We went to vampires. Yes, we went to Swinderby, and Swinderby had two-seat vampires side by side, vampire T-11s, and single-seaters were vampire fives. So, and we had one vampire nine, which was a five with this newfangled pressurization stuff. Off we went, and we did our dual flying in the T-11s, and when we had a solo sortie to do, we were launched in the single-seater. I was, again, extremely fortunate with my instructor, a chap called Dickie Lord, who was the sort of RAF fighter pilot type that we all wanted to be when we grew up, you know. And he was a very inspirational guy. He was just the instructor I needed. There was only once that he got it wrong with me, and wrong to the extent that I criticised him. I mean, something I can't believe that I did, sort of thing. And I was struggling with an exercise called steep turns, and this was where you had to turn steeply on instruments at high level, and it was quite a difficult exercise to do accurately. And my height was going up and down a couple hundred feet, and it had to stay inside a 100-foot limit. And he was talking away on the intercom about what he thought I was getting wrong, you know, and after a couple of goes at this, and he started talking again, I said, "Sir, I know what I should do. I just can't do it. Please leave me alone. You know, to constant. And that's the only time that I ever felt any sort of frustration about the way I was being taught. He was brilliant. He was just brilliant. We had one or two sort of incidents like people did in flying aeroplanes in those days. I remember taking off one day and we were just going off the edge of the airfield perimeter, and I said, "Sir," and pointed at the fuel gauge, which had gone down to naught. And he said, "Well, Farley," he said, "we've either got a very bad fuel leak or the gauge has failed." He said, "We should know which in a few seconds, won't we?" And, I mean, that was his attitude. And so we carried on for the normal length of sortie, minus about 5 minutes. One day I walked out to the aeroplane to fly it with him, Tillam. And in those days you did the sort of outside checks and the instructor would come and get in after you had got the aeroplane ready. May I go and ask? In those days, you know, you got the aeroplane ready and you strapped yourself in and the instructor joined you and said, "Everything all right?" Something like that. And you'd say yes, and he lashed himself in and off you went. He came, he said to me, "Is it all right?" And I said, "There are some screws missing, sir, on the left-hand acorn fairing." And this was a fairing that went between the fin, the boom and the tailplane on a Vampire. And it had got no screws in it. It had just been slotted into position. And I imagined that he had got the ground crew to take the screws out and, you know, set. But his reaction when I told him this made it quite clear that he hadn't. And he disappeared off in the direction of the hangar, leaving us in no doubt that this would have been a bad mistake by somebody in the hangar, you know. We had a very near miss in cloud when Hastings went over the top of us. I mean, I don't know how much above us it was, 10 feet, 15 feet. And we were on a radar-controlled circuit at Waddington. And so we'd gone to Waddington to practice things called GCAs, ground control approaches, and or practice for me to learn how to do them. Clearly there had been a bad boob in that these two aeroplanes in opposite directions at the same height nominally had passed each other in cloud when we were both supposed to be on radar. And he was clearly upset by this, and we went to the mess for lunch afterwards. And he said, "Right," he said, "well, that wasn't the best day, was it?" And he said, "Steward," and he called the steward over, and he got a whole camembert, you know, one of these big round jobs. And he just put it on a plate, and he set about it with a knife and fork, and he just ate it. I mean, when people have those sort of idiosyncratic sort of ways and so on, I mean you just think they're gods, don't you? You know, but he was clearly very affected by this, more so than me, because you know, youngsters don't sometimes appreciate the significance of things, do they? Anyhow, my main point about Diggy Lord was that he was a very good instructor and just right for me.
How was it configured, the T-11, with the instructor and the pupil?
Side by side. And side by side, very small cockpit, two ejector seats, and so not a lot of room. And a single instrument panel in the centre, you know, that you both looked at. Flight instrument panel. I mentioned earlier that it was hard school in those days. An example of what I mean was that we had accidents, people were killed. I remember one of us was killed on a solo exercise in the Vampire 5, which didn't have ejector seats. He lost control in a large thunderstorm and tried to jump out. He knocked the tailplane, the Vampire, the tailplane between the booms, he knocked that off with his body, which didn't do his parachute harness much good, and so he fell through an old lady's roof and into a bath wallop. The aeroplane was in bits all through the village, and we were put in a bus, we the students, and driven to the village, and we had to go around knocking on the doors asking if we could have the bits of our aeroplane back, you know. What can you imagine, I mean, today, what is it, the post-traumatic stress counselling or something, you know, if somebody has heard of an accident. It's a different world. It didn't bother us. That was how life was. That was normal. What I think when you're young, whatever you experience tends to be normal because you don't know any better, do you? So again, it's not a criticism, but it was clearly, looking back on it, it was hard school.